Alan Levy describes himself as a public interest cyber lawyer and soccer nut. In 1977, he joined Public Citizen, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization, and specializes in free speech issues arising on the internet. He's defended many cases involving suppression of speech and has two criteria that must be met before taking a case.
I like the idea of protecting speech of all kinds, even if I potentially disagree with it, although I'm constrained by the fact that I work for Public Citizen, which is a progressive organization, which isn't always happy with my defending speech with which some of my colleagues at Public Citizen disagree. Beyond that, the question is whether the plaintiff has a tenable claim and whether, for all sorts of claims that may be made against speech, there are degrees of validity and degrees of protection, and I have to assess two things, really. First of all, is the speech legally defensible, and will defending the speech in a particular instance help sort of advance the law by making it easier for other speakers? And really, both conditions have to be met for me to take a case.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lepkoski, and my co-hosts here today are Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. And we are just pleased as punch to welcome Paul Alan Levy, who's an American attorney at Public Citizen. He specializes in internet-related free speech issues, and he has done some pretty major work in that space. Paul, welcome. We're so happy to have you here. So, Wendy, do you want to take the lead here?
Well, Paul and I, like John and I, met at the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference years ago. And the late lamented Computers yeah. Freedom and Privacy Conference, indeed. And we've stayed in touch ever since. It's interesting to talk to somebody whose specialty is free speech at this point, because so many people are invoking free speech for things that really don't sound to me like free speech. Is it frustrating? It must be.
Yes. But, I just tend my little garden.
Okay.
Or my big garden, I should say.
Okay. So what is the garden that you tend?
Well, I litigate on behalf of people who are being attacked for what they say online. When defensible, and of course it's not always defensible, but when defensible, I help them protect their rights.
Where do you draw? This is something that's come up a lot in Britain lately. As I'm sure you know, we have the Online Safety Act coming into force. A lot of small sites are being forced to scramble and do a lot of paperwork to decide whether they are risky sites and all the rest of it. And there's all these laws people have proposed in the States with age verification and the Kids Online Safety Act and so forth.
Right.
Where do you draw the line in terms of what kind of speech you'll defend?
Personally, I like the idea of protecting speech of all kinds, even if I potentially disagree with it, although I'm constrained by the fact that I work for Public Citizen, which is a progressive organization, which isn't always happy with my defending speech with which some of my colleagues at Public Citizen disagree. Beyond that, the question is whether the plaintiff has a tenable claim, and whether, for all sorts of claims that may be made against speech, there are degrees of validity and degrees of protection, and I have to assess two things, really. First of all, is the speech legally defensible, and will defending the speech in a particular instance help sort of advance the law by making it easier for other speakers? And really, both conditions have to be met for me to take a case. You know, sometimes I'll give people advice and say, you know, this is really very interesting. This is not a case for me, but these are other people who might consider defending you. And sometimes I have to be pretty candid and say, you know, you've got a problem here and you ought to settle it as best you can.
The way that I was seeing it in what I've read about your work is that you're protecting less powerful people from real bullies much of the time, too.
Yes. Yes. By and large, that's the theory. That's the shtick.
Well, one of the current bullies is Elon Musk's team of genius vigilantes that are going out. And they're not only going through the files that government agencies, they've been going online and trying to find traitors to Trump. And have you had any contact with people victimized by that bunch?
I have not heard from any of them. You know, again, you know, it depends on what it is and what the claim is. You know, if it's a threat of prosecution by Ed Martin, who's the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia, who's taken to send out letters claiming he's going to conduct an investigation and consider prosecution, implicitly consider prosecution of people who have made statements adverse to the doggy apparatchiks. I do like to call it doggy instead of the preferred pronunciation, and I wish more people would take that up. But, you know, criminal defense work is not something that I do and that I'm competent to do. So I'm not likely to take one of those. If it's a threat of civil litigation, that's a different matter. That's the kind of stuff I do.
I suppose with Elon Musk, you might have an opinion of his claim to be a free speech advocate.
No, he's definitely in favor of speech that he likes.
Yeah.
It's not clear that he is in favor of the freedom to say things he doesn't like.
I'm not sure. Have you been following the story of Elon Musk and the Royal Society?
No.
A couple of months ago, a prominent scientist in this country named Dorothy Bishop publicly resigned from the Royal Society in protest that they were not enforcing the code of conduct on Elon Musk. And but when nothing happened about beginning of mid-February, she was followed up by Stephen Curry, who wrote an open letter demanding that the Royal Society take some kind of action. And yesterday, they held,
forgive me for not knowing what the Royal Society is.
I'm sorry. The Royal Society is the preeminent fellowship organization for scientists in this country. You have to be a very significant scientist to be made a fellow.
And is Elon Musk a fellow?
Elon Musk is a fellow on the basis of his scientific and technical contributions. And so 3,500 people signed the letter, various people in the science community, you know, not all of them fellows of the society, which is actually smaller than that.
Right.
And on yesterday, they had a meeting with 150 fellows, and so far they've still taken no action against Musk, but they published a statement saying, you know, we must uphold science around the world. And so today, there's been another fellow has resigned in protest. And so this is kind of an ongoing story of, you know, what they're basically saying is we have this code of conduct, and one of the things you're not supposed to do is attack other scientists, and you're supposed to uphold the standards of science.
Right.
And, you know, so this is why Musk is coming under fire there. I can't describe what it's like sending your Nobel laureate back, really. I mean, it's just it's a very big deal for a scientist to resign from the
yep.
Um, I think my biggest concern right now is whether we actually have a rule of law, or whether court cases will be just, or court decisions will be just disregarded by the government or by whoever else might be involved. You know, maybe you have a slap kind of lawsuit, and they get, you know, they just continue to do whatever it is they were doing, regardless of what the court tells them to do.
Yeah, yes. Well, many of my colleagues are bringing cases like that, and it remains to be seen whether courts are willing to enforce their judgments and whether the Supreme Court's going to uphold it. The issue apparently is being presented currently in the form of the effort to dismiss the special counsel. That may be the first case that presents that. I mean, it's not a free speech issue specifically, although perhaps the special counsel is being cashiered because he's on the wrong side of things.
Which case is the special counsel in?
That would be somebody whose surname is Dellinger, and I am not coming up with his first name. Trump purported to fire him, and he sued over it. And he's been ordered reinstated at this point on a permanent injunction, as I understand it.
And I thought I thought a special counsel was somebody who was assigned to a particular case, but this was.
No, there's something called the Office of Special Counsel, which protects whistleblowers in the government.
Okay. Right.
And it was Hampton Dellinger.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
A guy with two surnames.
Well,
he's a hero now, so I shouldn't play on his name, but what can I say? I'm a New Yorker.
What is the status of that case?
As I understand it, and it's really only what I read in the newspapers and on the sort of the comments by lawyers on Blue Sky, there's now a permanent injunction that's on appeal. And so far as I know, there's no stay of the injunction, but it's not clear that the injunction is being complied with either.
Yeah.
I haven't followed it closely enough. It's really what I read in the newspapers.
How would you know if the injunction was being complied with? He'd be let back in the building and he'd get a paycheck? Is that how you would know?
Certainly being let back in the building and allowed to direct. I mean, the Office of Special Counsel has staff, and he would be allowed to direct the staff.
Does it still have staff? These are the kinds of questions everybody's asking. Is like, is this?
I can't answer that question.
No, I know, but it's just, you just cannot tell what the state of functioning is of the U.S. government, which is just staggering.
Right. I mean, you know, it's like Twitter, right? You know, you go in and you break things, and if the server goes down, you know, that's the problem of the people who use Twitter. Unfortunately, it might be the Medicaid payments that are going down, and that's rather more serious.
Or the Social Security payments.
But should we get back to free speech issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. Well,
Forgive me.
I was thinking of the, you know, if the rule of law is diminished or completely flushed, then that affects everything, right? Including free speech.
It certainly does. I mean, although in the nature of things, I tend to represent defendants rather than plaintiffs, because I represent people who are facing lawsuits over their speech. So although most of my colleagues think in the mode of lawyers helping plaintiffs, I tend to think about lawyers helping defendants, and defendants aren't affected I mean, they're affected by the cost of litigation, obviously, and the threat of litigation. But the plaintiff in my typical case is seeking a judgment against my class of clients. And my job is to protect them against the lawsuits and the judgments.
Well, one thing you might do is define, I mentioned SLAPP a minute ago, kind of define SLAPP and how those suits are.
Strategic litigation against public participation is, in the classic sense, a lawsuit that's brought not necessarily with the hope of prevailing in the litigation, but in the hope of suppressing speech, either by cowing the speaker into silence, and cowing other potential speakers into silence by the threat of similar litigation, or making it just too ridiculously expensive to defend your speech. And so a number of states have enacted special protections for people faced with that kind of litigation that, number one, gives them an early out from the litigation and shifts the expense to the plaintiff if the anti-SLAPP motion to dismiss is granted.
Yeah, and the way that could work is that a corporation that has, a dozen lawyers and kind of an endless supply of money for lawyers could just kind of wear
That's
a
right. I
smaller
mean,
person down.
that's the danger. And if the plaintiff is Donald Trump or Elon Musk, they don't really care about the prospect of an award of attorney fees because, if you're rich as Croesus, you can pay the costs. But for many potential plaintiffs, the threat of having your case dismissed quickly and then having to pay attorney fees is a potential deterrent. And at the same time, it's an assurance to would-be speakers that they can have their rights protected and that a lawyer might be willing to take their case because they can get paid by an award of attorney fees. I mean, the laws work well against most plaintiffs and to favor most speakers, but it's not a panacea because a super rich person can do what they want. And then the other impact, wholly apart from the award of attorney fees and the stopping of the litigation, is the Streisand effect. In that, sometimes bringing a stupid case over protected speech just results in more attention to the thing you're trying to suppress. And many savvy defendants will deploy the Streisand effect to punish the plaintiff for bringing the case in the first place.
Well, big companies like to enforce their trademarks and their copyrights as a tool of suppressing free speech and other kinds of speech,
Right,
even
that
hate
does
speech.
happen, and that's we've litigated a number of cases in that area where copyright is being used not because of a genuine concern about loss of market for the work, but because it's a way of harassing a speaker, and in the trademark area, preventing people from using the name of the person they're criticizing effectively to call public attention to their criticisms. And that's certainly a line of cases that we've done and done pretty effectively over the years.
Well, in this area, are there legal protections that should exist that still don't exist?
Well, one of the problems that we're having in the anti-SLAPP area is that there's a serious question about whether anti-SLAPP laws are, generally speaking, state laws, and they apply in state court. So plaintiffs often try to bring their claims in federal court and argue then that the special anti-SLAPP procedures don't apply in federal court. And although the courts of appeals were generally of the view 20 years ago that anti-SLAPP laws apply in federal court cases, there's much less unanimity, and there's a real division among the courts of appeals that's still unresolved by the Supreme Court. One solution to that would be to get an anti-SLAPP law enacted at the federal level. But I think in the current Congress, there's no way that Trump would sign it. And it's not clear that Republicans would even favor the legislation because many Republicans have delighted in using litigation to suppress their opponents. Despite, I might add, interestingly enough, their general posture that litigation is bad and trial lawyers are bad, but they're perfectly glad to employ trial lawyers to oppress their political opponents.
Yeah, the state of Texas oppressed one of their political opponent, well, not cultural opponents. They banned Pornhub from being viewed by Texas citizens, and that's spawned some strange suits. But have you encountered things like that in other areas of, things that a lot of people would rather not see, but the people that produce this content feel they have a right to exhibit it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't
Where do you
say
draw
I'm
the
involved.
line?
I can't say I'm involved in any of the so-called adult entertainment litigation. It's not something that Public Citizen would be particularly interested in having me litigate. And I mean, the law in that area is murky.
Well, it's not really a ban, too. It's actually a requirement to verify age, which
Yes.
is a requirement that's very hard
It's hard. It's hard.
to
It's hard
meet.
to do. It's hard to do effectively. And I suppose, I mean, I understand that the argument is that if it's hard to do effectively, in effect, it's suppression because you could be held liable for failure to do it sufficiently.
It's hard
Though,
to do, even in this country where it's actually the law, it's hard to do and be privacy preserving. And I think there was a study in France a year or two back that
right.
found that there weren't any age verification mechanisms that were sufficiently privacy protecting for French legal taste. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to do it. It's reasonable to want to restrict adult content to adults, right? It's just a very difficult thing to enforce.
Right.
And it's kind of a free speech issue. It's not exactly the kind that you normally deal with, as you say, but
Shall we sing Tom Lehrer's song here?
Smut. I love it, smut.
Smut. I love it. It's
Yes.
something I can't glut, and so forth.
Yes.
It's a habit I can't glut.
I remember
Anyway,
something about
it's
my
really weird. I
important.
mean, there part of this is about, not just trying to suppress speech, but trying to suppress that which you do not like.
Right. And
And we have a lot of
there's
that going
plenty
here.
of that going around. Now, and look, there's always been plenty of that going around. But one of the reasons I do what I do is to try to at least increase the protections for people who want to say things that may be true, but make other people uncomfortable.
How did you actually get into this? Because you started out at Private Citizen doing
Public
late.
Citizen, please.
What did I say?
Public citizen. You
I
said
know you're
private
into
citizen.
privacy, Wendy, but it's
I
Public
said
Citizen and
private
not Private
citizen.
Citizen.
Okay. Well, when you started at Public Citizen, you were doing workers' rights, really.
Yeah, although, I like to think that there's been a continuity in my career. I spent the first 25 years here representing workplace loudmouths. And now I represent online loudmouths. And being something of a loudmouth myself, it works for me. I mean, I can tell you that the way I got into it was at some point, Public Citizen decided it wanted me to do less of the union democracy work. And it just so happened that somebody who had a website attacking Terminix and that family of companies, Terminix and ServiceMaster and a few other home services companies, let us say. True Green, I think, was another one. She had a website, which was a consumer complaint website about those companies, and she had the word Terminix and their other corporate names in her meta tags. Remember those? Back in the days of Alta Vista, this was an effective way to get your content before eyes, and they sued her for trademark infringement, and they sought a preliminary injunction. And even though she lived in Yuba City, California, they sued her in Memphis, Tennessee, where they're headquartered. So she sent a plaintive letter to Ralph Nader, and he referred it over to Public Citizen, and that was my first case in the internet free speech area.
And what was your argument in that case?
Around the same time, a number of flight attendants at what used to be called Northwest Airlines called in sick in the evening hours of December 31, 1999, because they were concerned about the impact of Y2K on the computers that run the airline systems and the air traffic control systems. Or at least they said that's what they were concerned with. And Northwest Airlines sued the Teamsters Union and Teamsters Local 2000, which was a reform local that my Union Democracy clients had won offices in. And then they sued a bunch of individual flight attendants, both the officers of that local and two flight attendants who had websites on which people were posting comments about the dangers of flying in the evening hours of December 31, 1999. And Northwest Airlines complained that this was all a conspiracy to foment a wildcat strike. And they sued for damages for the wildcat strike. And along the way, they tried to identify the people who had posted on the websites of the two flight attendants who ended up being my clients. And so that was my first exposure to the issue of anonymous free speech and the use of litigation to try to uncover the names of people who said uncomfortable things. So really, from my successes in those two cases, the rest of my practice flowed. You know, you do a case, you protect online free speech, other people hear about it, and then they bring their cases to you. And so I built a practice out of that. 24
This is where the Dendrite case came in?
25 years, I'm still going. I'm sorry?
The Dendrite case came in?
Well, you know, the Dendrite case is a little different. I mean, after I started doing those cases, then I started looking for other cases in which to do it. And I don't actually remember how I heard about the Dendrite litigation in state court in New Jersey. But you know what actually what happened in that case is that when the trial judge got a request to conduct discovery to identify the anonymous people who had trashed Dendrite on a finance message board, he just had the sense that there was an issue there that the anonymous speakers ought to have a right to be heard before he forced them to be identified. And he required the plaintiff company to publish a notice on the message board saying, "We've asked for this discovery, and if you don't speak up, you might be identified." And somehow we heard about that case and we filed an amicus brief. The case went up. The judge did not protect all of the anonymous speakers. And then there was a request for review. But he protected some of the speakers, and Dendrite appealed to the appellate division, and we refiled at the appellate level the amicus brief, which we'd already submitted at the trial court level, and that resulted in the first appellate decision adopting what's come to be known as the Dendrite test, which really was a test that we proposed at our amicus brief. When I was in law school, the law professor who led sort of a basic course called Elements in the Law used to talk about how every brief needs to have an opinion kernel, which provides exactly what you want the court to say to protect your client. And the opinion kernel in my appellate brief, our appellate brief, but I was the principal author in the Dendrite case, laid out a test. And the appellate division bought it lock, stock, and barrel, which was very gratifying, obviously.
And since then, a lot of other courts have adopted it.
Right. Since then, a lot of other courts have adopted it.
Yeah.
And I'm always looking for new jurisdictions in which to make the Dendrite argument.
Yeah, the last time I saw you, you were very pleased that a new court had adopted it.
Yeah, the New York Appellate Division really adopted our test solidly, relatively short opinion, but it was shortened to that, as New York Appellate Division's decisions tend to be, but it was really shortened to the point, and it was an overwhelming victory for our analysis. I mean, what we've tried to do is suggest a way of thinking about these cases that produces a sensible test that gives people with meritorious cases the ability to identify their detractors and go on with litigation while screening out the weaker cases and protecting anonymity in those situations.
Well, as a podcast producer, I'm concerned about how much I can get away with in criticizing the usual suspects in Washington. And I won't even say their names sometimes because I'm concerned they might take offense, because that seems to be a good way to get Donald Trump offended and Elon Musk offended, is just to say something truthful about them, but that they won't admit is the truth. How do people like us cover our asses, you know, in this environment?
Well, one thing you do is carry libel insurance. Because, I mean, I really recommend that to people who are in the expression space, because if you say something that somebody else contains is defamatory and either threatens to sue you or sues you, your insurance coverage provides, I mean, you know, all the newspapers have it, you know, they have very high powered insurance, but assuming you own your own home, you can actually get libel coverage just by adding a comprehensive rider or an umbrella policy to your homeowner's insurance. And that means if you get sued, the insurance company is going to provide a lawyer for you, because that's their way of avoiding having to pay out your liability.
You probably shouldn't have a co-host who is based in Britain either, because it's much easier to sue people for libel and much more expensive here.
Yes, well, but you know, if you don't have assets in Britain, you don't really have to be worried about being sued in Britain.
No, they can let me be sued. And
well, that's right.
No, I was going to say.
I don't downplay the risk that Wendy runs, unlike the risk that somebody that's U.S.-based run. But, you know, they can sue you in Britain till the cows come home, and it doesn't do them any good if you don't have any assets there, because there's also a federal statute that addresses the problem of libel tourism. And if somebody gets a judgment against you in England and then tries to come and force it in the United States, the libel judgment has to meet the test of the First Amendment in order to be valid.
That's right. I learned about that when I was writing about one of the Holocaust denial cases. Yeah,
but what if we don't have any real influence? I mean, at what point are we just people studying their opinions? Yeah. I mean,
we're not, you know, I wrote about Scientology for Wired in 1994. And what somebody said to me, as long as you don't look up the skirts of their finances, they'll leave you mostly alone. And, you know, we're not investigative journalists turning up things that people really don't want to have turned up. I mean, if it's in Wikipedia, it's hard to sue us for libel for saying it.
Right.
We got a cease and desist at the
They can
well
sue
from
you. The
Scientology.
question is whether they can prevail or whether they can run you out of business with the cost of defending. I
Well,
mean,
you were talking about slap suits earlier, and the journalist Carol Cadwalladr, who did a lot to expose the Cambridge Analytica scandal in 2016, 2017, was the victim of what looks to me to be a slap suit. And actually, I think the last judgment she lost and was facing quite large sums of, I'm not sure what's happened since
I
then.
take it that this is somebody on your side of the pond.
Yeah, she was at the time an investigative journalist for The Observer,
Yeah.
and she gave a TED talk that contained a couple of sentences that offended Arron Banks, who was a very wealthy donor to the Brexit campaign. I think that's what he was, anyway. And it all got very unpleasant. I can send you a link about it if you're interested.
I recognize that defending these cases in England and indeed the rest of Europe is much more difficult because of the lack of First Amendment and the lack of anti-slap laws and so forth. I mean,
Well,
generally speaking, when you express pure opinions, they're not going to be def held to be defamatory, but then the line between what's opinion and what's fact isn't always a certain one.
the other problem is that in a libel case in Britain, the burden of proof is reversed.
Right, I understand.
And so it can become very, very expensive. And in about 10, 15 years ago, Simon Singh was the science journalist. Simon Singh was sued for comments he made about the British Chiropractic Association. Now, you wouldn't have thought that an association could sue a writer, but they felt sufficiently offended that they tried. And it was, you know,
Oh, I don't
it,
think there's any question that, I mean, certainly in the United States, if you, for example, criticize the National Rifle Association for this or that, and you may and your statements are false, they can sue you for defamation.
Okay. Well, in any case,
Just as a corporation could.
in any case, what the BCA, I think, was hope the Guardian had to settle because they had another libel case pending, and they couldn't afford to defend two of them,
Yeah.
and that left Simon on his own. And I think the BCA may have thought that as a writer, he would be easily cowed into silence. They
Right.
happened to pick on one of the very few writers who had quite a number of bestsellers behind him and could afford to take them on,
Right.
and they ended up losing. And the judgment in that case is a beautifully written defense of the public of the need to publicly disseminate science and to critique
Yep.
companies.
Good.
Well, just I'm going back to this thing about anonymous speech. Let's say you're posting anonymously and you're just out and out lying about the company and you're telling defamatory lies about the company. Do you is,
Under our test,
then you're not protected there, right?
under our test, the plaintiff company would likely be able to get an order identifying the speaker. And chances are I wouldn't be on the defense side in those cases because you don't make good law by taking hopeless cases. I only take cases where I think I have a reasonable shot at making good law. And in fact, in the case I won in New York, I declined to take the case at the trial court level because it was my judgment that the plaintiff could probably put in sufficient evidence to overcome the anonymous speaker's rights. But the case was, perhaps poorly litigated, or perhaps, it may well be that what the client was saying was true and they didn't feel comfortable denying it in an affidavit. But it was only when the case got to the appellate division and the plaintiff had not put in sufficient evidence of falsity that I thought the case was worth doing from a public interest perspective. I mean, it did help in that case this was a case about an operation purportedly based in Germany, but really, as far as I can tell, based in Dubai, that involved selling investments founded on cryptocurrency reserves. And it did help our appeal that around the time the case went up on appeal, a bunch of state securities commissioners began finding that the crypto company was offering an unregistered security in their jurisdictions and issuing bans against them. I think that undoubtedly colored the view of the appellate division about our case.
Kind of given where we are now,
It
what do you see
also
as the
helped in that case that we were able to point to threats of violence against our client, which made it much more understandable why our client would not want to be identified. I mean, some of the people who our client had identified as potential crypto scammers sort of started fantasizing in videos about having our client shot.
Wow.
So, you know,
Well,
that helped us explain to the appellate division why it's important to have as part of the test that you weigh the actual dangers of retaliation to the anonymous speaker in deciding whether the subpoena to identify the speaker ought to be enforced.
so the question I was going to ask is, what do you see as the biggest threats to online speech? Kind of given where we are now and kind of in the
I mean,
near
the biggest
future.
threat is the threat of online litigation, number one. And number two, the really misguided efforts to repeal platform immunity, which is something that exists under United States law. And I think not so much on the other side of the Atlantic. That is to say, Section 230,
Yeah.
which provides that an online platform can't be held liable for actionable speech posted on the platform. And although there is a consensus among, I would say, badly intentioned figures on the Republican side and unthinking people on the Democratic side, there seems to be a general move to taking away or limiting that kind of platform immunity. And the result, in my view, will be that platforms just won't be willing to host controversial speech anymore.
Where do you
Well, or maybe any user-generated content. It seems to me that it's extremely
Well, you know,
risky to have a
they'll
social media
undoubtedly be
site.
willing to host cat videos.
Where do you put the position of algorithms? Because it seems to me that there's some legitimacy in saying, well, the platforms develop the algorithms, they are in control of the algorithms, these are editorial choices that the platform makes, they should be responsible for what the algorithm decides to show people.
There are two problems with that argument as I see it. First of all, to the extent that there's an algorithm deciding what speech a platform is going to show more of or show less of, that actually represents a sort of publisher's choice about what speech to host that, in my view, is protected by the First Amendment. And second, you can't run a platform without having an algorithm which decides what comes higher and what comes lower. And so, if the rule is you get held liable if the algorithm promotes content that's later determined to be actionable, then any site that has an algorithm is going to be held liable. And that's a bad idea. Now, I mean, a variant on that is to say, well, you're only held liable if your algorithm favors content that produces a lot of views, so to speak. But that too, I mean, that's really a viewpoint-free choice. It just says if people are really interested in content, it'll be shown more. And
Well,
again,
different algorithms work different ways,
yes.
but sites like the more recently used sites like Blue Sky and Mastodon and so forth, the standard there is, well, on Mastodon, the standard is you follow certain people and you just get a chronological feed of what they post, and there's no interference by the site
Right.
at all. And I would, to me, that's, I mean, obviously there's an algorithm in the sense there is some computer program that says, this is a new message, this is in this person's feed, show this. That's an
Right.
algorithm, but it's not an algorithm like we meant, which is one that says, actually, this person is less interested in this guy, so we're going to show it to him later. Or Blue Sky allows users to create their own algorithm, to specify their own feeds and decide how they want to see things.
And to
Yeah,
pick from one
I haven't
feed or
figured that
another.
one. I'm on Blue Sky. I haven't figured that out yet because I'm a Luddite,
Yeah,
but maybe someday.
but a site
Well,
like,
I can speak to that. So on Twitter or Facebook, you
X.
have an algorithm that determines the. You have one feed, and that's determined by the algorithm.
Right.
But on Blue Sky, they let you select how you want the algorithm to be defined, and you can have multiple ways to present feeds. So you could have a feed of your best friends, or you could have a feed of all the members of a particular organization, or a feed of all reporters in a particular space, and you can pick from one to another. So it's a completely different way of doing things than the way that Twitter and Facebook have done it.
Right. Yep. These are all editorial choices.
Yeah. And on Blue Sky, you have a lot of control over the editorial
Right.
choices. They don't
It gives the,
presume to
as I
control it for
understand
you.
it from what you're saying, and it's above my technological knowledge what you're talking about.
It just.
Since, although I litigate cases in the online context, my technical sophistication is pretty low.
It's, it's an interesting question because we don't actually know how direct the control a platform has over its algorithm is. Maybe it got programmed years ago and has been, it's been tweaked so many times, people don't really know exactly what it does.
Right.
And the other part is that, granted, a newspaper editor sits down with a newspaper and tries to arrange the front page in such a way that people will buy the newspaper.
Yep.
But there seems to be something more like behavioral control in the way that platform algorithms select what to show people, and
Right.
particularly in cases of YouTube and TikTok, what to show you next.
Yeah, and yet, wouldn't you think that from a user's perspective, it's better to see stuff that you're interested in than to see stuff that you're not interested in?
Well, that depends. I mean, do you remember there was an article years ago
I mean,
about when
if
Pico
I
was
go
around?
to a college that has broad distributional requirements, which is what I chose to do, then of course I'm going to see lots of stuff that I might be less interested in, but that somebody has decided is to my educational benefit. While if you go to most big state universities, you're going to get to take the courses you want to take. There's something to be said for either approach to what content you're going to see.
I think the question you should be asking is who should decide what you want to see?
But the thing I was going to say is, do you remember?
In choosing to go to the Slack that I attended, I went to a place, really without having thought about these issues, I confess, but I chose to go to a place that required me to get a broad liberal arts education. There's a marketplace out there, and you get to go to the, whether it's the college or the platform that provides the kind of content that you want to be exposed to. And if you choose to go to a place that's relatively unfiltered, you know, that's a choice. And if you go to a place that gives you exactly what you think you want,
no, what it thinks, you know, what it thinks you want. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? Because you're talking as though these algorithms are actually accurate, but it's been known ever since the early TiVos, you know, that the TiVo will draw. There was a guy who wrote an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, about my TiVo thinks I'm a Nazi. And he had watched like a history program or something, and it started showing him more and more stuff about Nazis. So he tried to convince it that it was, that he, you know, he tried to retrain it with, I don't know, decorating documentaries or something.
Yep.
And now it thought he was gay. I mean, you know, it just, it didn't get him anywhere. You know, and that's,
I mean,
and
it's a difficult thing. So, I mean,
sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the algorithms are trying to they prioritize engagement. I'd say they do. I mean, I shouldn't speak as though I'm speaking about all algorithms that are being used in social media, but I think mostly about what Facebook is doing and what Twitter was known to do. And I think X still does it, though. Maybe it wants to show you stuff that's more incendiary. I don't know. But the outcome they're looking for is engagement.
The incendiary draws clicks.
It does. It draws clicks. So that works for engagement, though.
Right.
There may be other approaches to produce engagement. And Facebook may be more benign in what it shows you, but the goal is the same, to get you to keep clicking, keep scrolling, and you know, to hold your attention. And presumably it's so that they can show you ads periodically.
Show you ads that might produce clicks on the ads and therefore revenue.
And one difference in Blue Sky is that they don't have ads. So they're not trying to show you
so
anything.
So far, I mean,
so far.
What their revenue model will be in the long run, I think, remains to be seen.
Exactly.
Facebook used to have much less in the way of advertising.
And Google at one time had no advertising at all and thought that advertising was pernicious and would distort the search results. And guess what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we all kind of replacing our trust in Mike Masnick as a board member of Blue Sky, that he's going to keep it from turning evil. But he may not, you know, it's very, very difficult to know because, as you say, we have no idea what their business, they have stated how they hope to make money. But it remains to be seen whether they can actually do it and whether they can stick to it under the pressure of, but you should be making more profits.
Right. Yes.
Incentivization.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Cory Doctorow.
Well, and of course, Mike has only one vote, but, you know.
Yeah, but I don't think he would have. I would trust his good
judgment.
Is judgment enough to think that he wouldn't have joined the board if he didn't seriously?
If he didn't think, yes, well, we can hope.
Yes.
I wonder if an algorithm could be seen as suppression of speech because it shows some things and not others.
Of course, it both suppresses and promotes speech by its very nature.
Well, I'm a big fan of online satire and parody, and I know you are. I read that you defended a case that was brought by Walmart, I believe, where a parody.
Yes, and another one that was threatened by the NSA.
And in the current environment, is it dangerous now to make fun of these powerful people?
I mean, if they choose to sue you, you have to defend it. That's, to my mind, not a reason not to engage in speech. It is a reason to be careful. You know, there are things you can do to make your speech more defensible, or things you can fail to do to result in it being less defensible. And it's worth sort of thinking about those things, you know. From in a libel context, we actually have an article on our website about it's a guide to bloggers and nonprofits on how to write with libel in mind. And you could conceive of a similar document about how to do effective parodies and satires that minimizes the risk. I mean, the risk of successful litigation, at least. I mean, if somebody is rich enough, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, there's not jolly much you can do to deter them from suing because they can afford to pay the fees.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Paul. This has been a great conversation.
Nice to chat with you guys.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks so much.
I should never, I'd like to speak with, I'll use the Southernism, not to speak with y'all. Because
that's to speak with y'all.
It may be bad English, but at least gender neutral.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Ciao.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.